This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Inside the crisper of Lynn Coulter's fridge, you may very well find some small brown paper envelopes. They contain heirloom seeds. Lynn Coulter is our guest this afternoon, and we will talk with her about gardening and heirloom seeds. She's a gardener and a writer and the author of Gardening with Heirloom Seeds, Tried and True Flowers, Fruits, and Vegetables for a New Generation. At the outset of the book, in the first chapter, A Celebration of Seeds, Lynn Coulter says, heirloom seeds are much more than the promise of next summer's crookneck squash or mammoth sunflowers. They are living antiques handed down from one generation to another. They are an inheritance of flavor or beauty from long ago and often far away. Listeners, I invite your questions about gardening and heirloom seeds for our guest, Lynn Coulter. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, use the toll-free number, and that number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Lynn Coulter's book, Gardening with Heirloom Seeds, is published by the University of North Carolina Press. Again, the phone number's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Lynn Coulter, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Celeste, thank you so much for inviting me to appear on your program.
Oh, it's my pleasure. How does your garden grow this June, this day before summer begins?
Oh, my garden here in Georgia is burning up, I'm sorry to say. Our temperatures have been in the 90s. We've had very little rain for the last few weeks, but I'm trying to keep my plants going.
Yeah. What do you got out there?
I've got tomatoes growing this year. Heirloom tomatoes are some of my favorites. I have Brandywine and Rutgers varieties, which are heirlooms that you can find at many garden centers, unlike most heirlooms, which are a little harder to come by. But I've got the tomatoes, and I've got some Moon and Stars watermelons.
I had never seen that before, and you've got a picture of that in your book. Tell us about that. Describe it.
Well, Moon and Stars watermelons, I have heard them called the poster child for the heirloom seed movement because they kind of became legend for a long time. We believe that the Moon and Stars watermelon variety was introduced in this country around 1926 by the Peter Henderson Seed Company of New York. But somewhere along the line, the variety fell out of the commercial seed trade. It may have been because the variety, the melons are kind of roly-poly, and they don't stack and ship particularly well. So they're not great for the supermarket trade.
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, gardeners would pass around word of these delicious melons, but you couldn't find them anywhere. And they really are beautiful. They're kind of cannonball-shaped, although they can grow quite large. They have a dark green rind, and as the name suggests, there's a big golden yellow blotch that looks like the moon on the rind, and it's surrounded by lots of little sunny yellow freckles that look like the stars. When you slice them open and they make that nice crack, you know, like when you cut open summer watermelons, the flesh inside is pink, and it's really sugary sweet, and it's studded with all these little ebony seeds. It's really delicious. But as I said, Moon and Stars had kind of disappeared until a gentleman named Kent Whaley, who runs the nonprofit Seed Savers Exchange out of Decorah, Iowa, happened to mention, I believe it was on a television interview back, I can't remember how far back, 70s or 80s perhaps, that he was looking for this old variety and couldn't find it anywhere. And an elderly gardener living in Missouri called him up and said, I've got that watermelon you're looking for.
Hmm.
He sent Kent some of the melons, and he and his wife, Diane, who co-founded Seed Savers Exchange, grew them, increased the seed, and started sending it to gardeners across the country. And now it's widely available again. You can find it through a lot of commercial sources.
It is a spectacular fruit. I mean, it looks like the night sky,
mm-hmm.
you know, on the outside. And then on the inside, it's that beautiful red. And I guess I will never complain about seeds in watermelon ever again.
That's right. For some reason, it seems to me that some seedless varieties, some of the newer melons, just don't have that old flavor.
And here with this melon, you know, you can save these seeds. And
that's right.
Boy.
That's what heirloom seeds are all about. They grow true to type, which simply means that if you plant the seeds of an heirloom plant, you get baby plants that resemble the parents. Modern hybrids, which are what most of our plants are today, you know, the things, the fruits, the flowers, the vegetables we buy at garden centers, hybrids come from the cross of varieties, and their seeds will sometimes be sterile or more often they simply will produce baby plants that do not resemble the parent. They'll revert to one of the parental forms. But that's the nice thing about heirlooms. Their seeds produce baby plants like the original, and that makes them economical to grow.
Hmm. Outside of being true to type, what makes a seed an heirloom seed?
Excuse me. Well, by definition, heirlooms are varieties that have been around for at least 50 years. And some gardeners set the bar even higher at 100 years or older. In the book, I'm a little more loose about this because I'm a kind of a laid-back gardener, and I think anything can be an heirloom if it's passed down from one generation to another and if you value it and treasure it because of where it came from or because it simply has its own value. Just as if you inherit a mahogany table from your mother, maybe it's not technically an antique mm-hmm. if it's 40 years old, but you still value it. And so some of the older varieties are, in my opinion, heirlooms, even if they're not quite 50 years old.
Yeah. Well, I just hand it down, you know, a couple of generations, and mm-hmm. before you know it,
there you go.
It's an heirloom.
Right.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I was also going to add, too, that heirlooms, because they have been around a long time, also tend to be plants that have adapted to whatever soil or weather conditions they're grown in. So they're often easier to grow than some of our modern plants.
Yeah, and you would think that, before I dipped into gardening with heirloom seeds, I thought, well, we have hybrids for a reason, and maybe these heirloom plants are a little trickier to grow, but it's not the case. They're, as you say, survivors.
Well, you're right, too, though, because many of our hybrids have come along because there's been a demand for improvements. There's been a demand for hybrid roses that have these big, lush, gorgeous blooms and, you know, strong canes that aren't easily pushed over in the wind. But sometimes, along with the improvements, we've lost other characteristics that made the plants worth growing. For example, in the fruit and vegetable world, economics has kind of driven some of the changes to our plants. Growers wanted tomatoes that could store for a long time without spoiling, so they'd last a long time on supermarket shelves. And they wanted these nice, perfect, uniform red globes that look very pretty when they're stacked in pyramids on the shelf. But they've tended to lose some of the delicious taste and flavor and texture, some of the meaty, old-fashioned tomato-y taste when they've bred for other characteristics. So some hybrids are certainly worth growing, and you know, many, mm-hmm. many hybrid tomatoes are great today because they're bred to resist all these wilts and blights and diseases. But other heirlooms are worth growing simply because if they're flowers, they tend to have richer, deeper perfumes, and if they're food crops, they tend to have better taste.
Yeah. It seems the interest in heirloom seeds and heirloom plants is growing. Is that true?
I think so, too, yes. I got interested in heirlooms about 7 or 8 years ago. I have worked for a long time as a freelance journalist for magazines and newspapers. And in the space of about 2 years, I was contacted by 3 different editors at major magazines about doing articles on these old-fashioned plants. And I think there's a real movement back to these wonderful old varieties. And also, I think it's just that any gardener wants something that no other gardener has. I mean, that's just our nature, to look for something that's special and unique. And when you've roamed all the garden centers and you've picked up all the flats of marigolds and vincas and they all look exactly the same, and then you start looking at some of the heirloom seeds and you see these wonderful old morning glories or nasturtiums that you can't get anywhere else, you sort of get interested in those.
Yeah. And, oh, I was just floored by some of the photographs in this book of some of the flowers, the cornflower jubilee gem.
Oh, yeah.
What a stunner. And the cosmos, you know, you think of that as such kind of a garden variety.
Yes, an ordinary plant.
And here you have seashells and dancing petticoats.
Aren't the names wonderful,
yeah,
too?
Yeah. Maybe you tell us a little bit about the names, and then we'll take a call.
Well, the names, oh gosh, there's such a variety of names. When you read through seed catalogs, if you're like me, you're just tempted by all the different descriptions. There are tea time 4 o'clock, for example, which kind of evoke the, well, 4 o'clock's open in the late afternoon or on cloudy days anyway, but the name tea time kind of summons up all these notions in my head about having tea in the garden in the afternoon when the flowers are opening. There are a lot of beans and peas with very evocative names, like the Cherokee Trail of Tears. These beans were believed to have been carried by the Cherokees when they made their forced march into Oklahoma in the 1830s. There are, let's see, 1,500-year-old cave beans, also known as the New Mexico cave bean, which were discovered in New Mexico, sealed in a clay pot, that many years ago. So some of the names are just wonderfully evocative.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is gardener and writer Lynn Coulter. She's the author of Gardening with Heirloom Seeds. We're talking about gardening. We're talking about heirloom seeds this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, stories about gardening, also invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener now in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. Comment. In terms of our vegetables, you know, in terms of the consumer, it's very sad, the lack of diversity. You know, there's so much standardization that went into it. I'm a big fan of Chinese, traditional Chinese. And when you look at the variety of vegetables that the Chinese have, you know, they have vegetables for winter, you know, it has to do with the yin and yang and, you know, the for heat and cold and all. It's very sad that we've gotten to this point. So that's my only comment, and I'll go off here.
I agree with you completely. We've lost so much choice in our foods, especially. I was just thinking as you were speaking about when I was researching radishes, for example. In 1888, a Burpees catalog listed 17 different varieties of radishes, and I believe they're still one of the most widely grown vegetables in Japan. Well, today, of course, you'd be hard-pressed to find that much selection at all, and we hardly eat them except as, you know, sliced into green salads, or maybe we shape them into a little frilly rose for an appetizer tray, but there really, at one time, were many more varieties of all these plants available, and it's a shame that we've lost that genetic heritage.
Mm. What do you like to do with radishes?
Oh, I... well, I have something that may not sound good to most people, but I do like it. It's a variety called the French breakfast radish, and it dates back to about 1879. It matures very quickly. The radishes are ready to pull and eat in about 24 days after you sow them in the garden. They have scarlet red tops and a white flesh, and they recommend that you eat them in the French fashion. Now, I'm not sure this is really how they eat them in France, but I've tried them, and they're very good. You give them a quick scrub under some cold running water, bring them in, you dip them in butter, and coarse salt, and then you eat them with your buttered toast for breakfast.
Mm.
They're very good.
Sounds good.
Even though most people don't eat radishes for breakfast anymore.
I haven't, but that sounds really good, and I think it would be lovely with a hard-cooked egg.
That might be good.
Yeah, and some toast. Very, very interesting. Can you cook radishes?
I have not cooked them. I'm sure you can. I have heard about the early Egyptians actually pressed radish seeds for oil and used it in their cooking, much as we use olive oil today.
Huh.
I have not cooked any radishes, though, but that's something I might have to try.
Yeah, just a quick saute?
Yeah, sure.
I don't know.
Worth
a try. Why not? This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, if you'd like to join the discussion this afternoon, give us a call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, writer and gardener Lynn Coulter, author of Gardening with Heirloom Seeds. You mentioned seed savers, and that's, of course, one source for heirloom seeds. What are some others?
Well, Seed Savers is probably the granddaddy of them all because it is a nonprofit. It's the organization that's out in Decorah, Iowa. And they have, I believe, about 24,000 different varieties of flowers, fruits, vegetables, and grains that they have cataloged. They even have an offshoot organization called the Flower and Herb Exchange. Well, actually, that's the one that has the flowers. The main organization has your vegetables, fruits, and grains. But there are many other sources for heirloom seeds. Some of the commercial seed sellers who contributed, you mentioned the beautiful photographs in the book, and thank you for that compliment. I did work with several commercial seed sellers who provided those images. There's a wonderful source for antique flowers called Select Seeds in Union, Connecticut. It's run by Marilyn Barlow, and that's a wonderful source for many old flowers. Renee's Garden, run by Renee Shepherd in Felton, California, is also a source of seeds. But there are many nonprofits out there, too. And there are many places to see heirloom gardens growing. For example, Old Sturbridge Village in Massachusetts, Old Salem Gardens in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, of course, Monticello. There are a number of places you can actually see the flowers growing and vegetables.
Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign on line 4. Hi.
Hi. I was wondering if possibly the interest in heirloom vegetables and plants can be contributed partly to the increase in interest in organic produce and kind of the slow food movement?
I think so, yes, I definitely think so. As I mentioned, because heirlooms have been around for so long, many of them have adapted to the climate that they're grown in, and they're unusually resistant to a lot of the pests and diseases that we normally have to spray for. Mm-hmm. So if you want to grow a more natural, pure garden, if you don't want to have to worry about using so many sprays, heirlooms are definitely a good choice. They're very resistant and vigorous and often prolific.
Okay, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
And on that topic, you can use plants as lures. This was interesting. Amaranths, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, including, here's a lovely name, Love Lies Bleeding.
Yes.
apparently is a good lure for cucumber beetles, so plant that near the cukes, and they'll go for the flowers. You might lose some flowers, but you should maintain your cucumbers.
Right. You can plant something, I call it a green sacrificial victim. You can plant something that you know is going to get covered up with bugs, and that's okay. You hope the bugs eat those few plants and leave the rest of the garden pretty much in peace. Yes, amaranths, I believe, got their nickname Love Lies Bleeding because of their appearance. They have these long, rope-like, dangling tassels of bright red flowers. Well, there are other colors like chartreuse green, but mostly bright red flowers, and they look like blood, I suppose. They were very popular in Victorian times when there were these mammoth plants that would grow to 12 feet, And there are accounts of people who would let the stems of the plants intertwine overhead to form these living tunnels for ladies and gentlemen to stroll through arm in arm in the evenings. But, of course, those particular plants kind of fell out of favor because we just don't have room for these 12-foot giants anymore.
How interesting. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Georgetown, line one. Hi.
Hi, Josh Hayes here. My wife and I are just moving out to Georgetown, just east of the town here. We've got about 18 acres, and we really like buying heirloom vegetables and planting them in our garden. I guess my question is, I've heard some sort of horror stories. I know all the industrial hybrids are now patented, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts on some of the frivolous lawsuits that seem to be commonplace these days by companies who have patented these hybrids and are kind of, or not even just frivolous lawsuits, but these attempts to regulate and sort of register all plants out there. I know the USDA has a National Animal Identification System that's on tap for 2008, and they're moving towards agriculture, or towards vegetable gardens and planted things as well. And I didn't know if you had any thoughts about if the heirloom industry was in any danger from these attempts.
Well, first of all, Jeff, thanks for your question, and congratulations on having that much land. That sounds wonderful. Yes, I think it is a little scary to see these kinds of patents going in and restrictions being put on who owns a plant. But I do think, though, that with the help of nonprofits like Seed Savers Exchange and just the grassroots efforts of gardeners just like ourselves to keep the heirlooms going, that we'll be okay in that regard. But that's why it is important not to lose this genetic heritage that we have of these plants, and to keep them in ordinary gardeners' hands rather than the mega corporations who can then do what they will with them.
Yep, thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Other questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, Lynn Coulter, gardener and writer, author of Gardening with Heirloom Seeds. How can people interested in heirloom seeds find one another in communities like Georgetown or Champaign-Urbana?
Well, here again, I keep going back to Seed Savers Exchange, but they are a wonderful group, Celeste. You can simply get their catalog free, I believe it's still free, by logging onto their website, or you can actually join. And the last time I checked, I think actually my membership has lapsed, I'm sorry to admit, but the last time I joined, which was a couple of years ago, the membership fees were very reasonable, maybe $35, $50. For that price, you will get a catalog as well as a large book that lists the names and addresses of seed savers across the United States who are willing to trade or share their seeds with you. If you don't want to do that, you can simply check with your state agricultural department. Many states, such as Georgia, that's where I live, publish a market bulletin for farmers and consumers. I get mine free through the mail, and it lists, again, names and post office boxes or telephone numbers for gardeners who are willing to trade or share old-timey varieties. You might also check with your universities and colleges to see if they have any trial gardens that they're growing these varieties and would be willing to let you have some of the seeds. And I haven't tried it yet, but I've also thought it might be fun if you're new to an area. I've always heard about neighbors getting to know one another through cookie swaps, you know, particularly at the holidays. Everyone makes up a recipe of cookies, and they have a meeting at someone's house and share recipes. I thought, wouldn't it be kind of fun if you're new to an area to invite all your neighbors and do a seed swap and trade seeds of the varieties that grow in your area? So especially if this person is a newcomer, they can find out what grows well in the gardens.
Yeah, and gardeners are very generous folks.
They are. They really are.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Danville. Line one, hi.
Hi. I just had a comment about cooking radishes.
Yeah.
I actually did that. I was running low on vegetables, and I wanted to have some vegetables with my rice. And I sautéed in butter and soy sauce radishes, peas in a pod, and water chestnuts.
Ooh. And how were they? What was the taste like?
It was actually very good. Just gave a little bit of a zing, kind of like the water chestnuts, but more of a zing.
Oh, the, in texture.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Ah, well, that's an idea for dinner tonight.
Thank you.
Sounds good.
You're very welcome. Thank you. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, if you'd like to talk with us this afternoon. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Another idea, I suppose, for getting to know more about heirloom plants would be the folks who are your growers at the farmer's market. I suspect that the growers at farmers markets are playing some role in bringing old varieties to our attention. That's one of the charms about going to the farmers market is that, for example, when I looked in your book and I saw those photographs of beets and carrots, all those varieties, you are likely to find them at the farmers market and not at the grocery store.
That's a great suggestion, Celeste. Yes, exactly. Often the smaller farmers are more willing to try the old varieties, or they've grown them before and they know they're good. And they have that advantage in that they don't have to ship their produce a long way. And they're there to sell it, and hopefully they'll have a quick turnover so things stay fresh and they don't have to just choose varieties that are known to last a long time, even though the taste isn't there.
Yeah. Those carrots, there are so many varieties of carrots. How do they vary in taste? The colors and the shapes are wonderful. There's such variety there. Do they vary much in taste?
Well, some of the old varieties have actually been accused of not having a lot of taste. For example, that violet carrot has, and I have not grown that particular one, but I have read that it's not one of the more flavorful ones. The Danvers carrot, of course, is one that a lot of us probably grow, and they're very good, very crispy. I have also have not grown, but have read about the Royal Chantenay, which is supposed to be one of the best varieties. It's a very old carrot dating back to the 1880s. It's a real dark orange color, and it's supposed to have a very fine, smooth texture.
Do these carrots come to harvest time pretty much around the, they take the same amount of time to grow?
Yes, I think most of them probably do.
Yeah.
Carrots are difficult for me to grow in Georgia because our soil here is very clay-like, even though I've been trying to amend and improve mine for many years. But yes, I tend to choose the carrots that are shorter and stockier, simply so they won't have to grow a long time and try to break through our very hard soil.
Hmm. Yeah, here it can vary. You know, you can have a clay soil, you can have wonderful, dark, beautiful, loamy soil. So,
oh, you're lucky.
Kind of depends where you are, though, and how the land has been treated. Carrots, how do you collect the seeds from carrots now?
Well, carrots, you may not have ever seen carrot seeds,
right,
really, if you stop and think about it, because carrot seeds are not easy to collect, and they take 2 years for the carrots to put out their seed tops. What you have to do is a process called vernalizing, or exposing the carrots to enough cold to make them flower. This is tricky to do. If you live in an area that gets at least 10 weeks of cold weather, but not freezing weather each year, you can leave your carrots in the ground and just let them overwinter. The next spring, you take the mulch off and you wait for the leaves and then the seed stalks to appear. The problem is that sometimes you do get a freeze that kills the roots no matter what you try to do to save them. Another way to vernalize carrots is just to pick them as usual and cut back the green tops. Then you have to store them, and this gets really complicated. You have to put them in paper bags filled with wood shavings and wrap the paper bags in plastic bags and put the whole thing into the refrigerator, a little warmer than freezing, but around 40, 41 degrees Fahrenheit. You keep them there until the following spring when you replant them. Then, if you're lucky, you finally get the seed stalks, which you can watch until the seeds ripen and turn brown, and then you harvest them and store them or plant them. That's so much trouble for most people.
Yeah.
That we'll just, you know, go to a friend to trade for seeds, or we'll find a commercial source.
Yeah. Well, here we definitely are going to have frost and freeze.
Right.
So we're in zone 5 in this part of the state
of Illinois. Yes, even in Atlanta, where I am, you know, we're going to get some freezing weather, too.
Yeah. What do you like to do with carrots? They're a vegetable that is available year-round, so they're a good standby, mm-hmm. you know, when nothing else is very tasty. What do you like? How do you like to prepare them?
Oh, well, I'm a very simple cook, really. I grew up in the South, and I was raised on very plain, wholesome cooking. I like to just chop them up and put them in with a pot roast to simmer in a slow cooker so that they absorb a lot of the meaty broth and take on the flavor. You know, I might combine them with sliced onions and maybe toss in some peeled potatoes. Or I also just love to eat my vegetables raw and fresh.
Mm-hmm.
So I like to just chop the carrots into a green salad.
Oh, yeah, that sounds good. I like, at this time of the year, I like to cook them and either have them at room temperature or chill them. And while they're still warm, dress them with a little preserves and mustard.
Ooh, I've never tried them with that.
And
that
so if you like apricot preserves or peach,
yes.
Anything like that, marmalade?
Oh.
Works very well, too. And it's that way, it's you can do it ahead. And it's a nice cooling dish this time of the year when we're in the 90s.
Actually, that sounds a lot better than heating up my kitchen with a pot roast tonight. Yes.
Yeah, yeah. No, a pot roast for me is, that's not a 90-degree kind of
no,
thing.
No, you're right. It's not, yeah. not midsummer cooking, no.
Yeah, yeah, although pot roast is a good thing. A very good thing. That's something to look forward to for the fall. Let's talk a little bit about flowers and... one of the things that heirlooms have going for them, fragrance.
Mm-hmm.
What are your favorite fragrant heirloom flowers?
Oh, it would have to be sweet peas, which are available in so many different varieties in the heirloom world. I've heard so many people say that today's sweet peas are just, and I don't have a keen sense of smell, unfortunately, but I've heard so many people say that the modern varieties just don't have the rich, heady perfume of these old, old flowers. I have a lot of different sweet peas mentioned in the book. Let's see, I was just trying to remember. There's one that's supposed to be especially fragrant. There's one called Black Knight, K-N-I-G-H-T. Like the Knights of the Round Table.
Mm-hmm.
It's got dark purple or violet blooms, and it's a grandiflora, and it's supposed to be very, very fragrant. I wish I had a better nose for perfumes. Painted Lady is also a sweet pea that does particularly well in the South, in spite of our heat and humidity.
Okay.
It dates back to, we think, around 1730. And it was a strain, actually, that is said to have been saved by an Australian family who kept it under cultivation for generations. You can find it again now in the commercial seed market. Sometimes it's called Old Spice.
Hmm.
And there's a beautiful sweet pea with a wonderful scent that's very sweet called Flora Norton. It's a bright bluish color. Of course, blue is a hard to find color in the garden.
Yeah, it's so spectacular, though. Jubilee Gem, we mentioned earlier, is a blue cornflower.
Right.
That's
right.
A beauty.
Yes, those corns, that is a beautiful cornflower. I recently saw some growing at some garden I passed by, and I recognized it immediately.
Yeah, and here at Illinois, our school colors are orange and blue.
Ah, wonderful.
I thought, you know what we could do is we could pair Jubilee Gem with Diablo Cosmos.
Yes. And have your colors.
Yeah, and you can have that, you know.
Indeed you could.
Yeah.
Yeah, Jubilee Gem is an All-American Selections winner, too, which is simply a garden award that's given to plants that perform unusually well. And it won that award back in the 1930s, 1937, I believe. So it's been around for a while.
Wow, okay.
For good reason. It's just a beautiful plant.
Yeah, and that would be spectacular as a cut flower, too.
Probably not unless you had large handfuls, but it would, there again, in mixed bouquets, it would add that hard-to-find blue that's so attractive.
Yeah. Another spectacular flower, you mentioned the deep, dark reds, and there's a hollyhock in the book. I am failing to recall it now, but a spectacular, really deep, dark red, almost black.
I was going to say, I wonder if you're referring to, there are several hollyhocks that are almost black. And there again, I guess there's no true black in the flower world, but you have the maroon, the burgundy, the chocolate purple colors.
Mm-hmm.
There's a hollyhock called the Watchman that was grown by Jefferson at Monticello. And particularly on cloudy days, the flowers look almost black. They're satiny single blooms. Let's see. I'm not sure if that's the one you're thinking
yeah,
of.
Yeah, I think it is. The hollyhock seems to be a plant that has fallen out of fashion.
It is, and here in the South, I think part of the reason may be that they're so susceptible to disease. In fact, they've almost been wiped out in the past by a fungus. In the 1870s, hollyhocks were hit hard all across the United States, and only a few strains survived. Finally, around the early 1900s, we figured out that it was a good gardening practice to burn infected hollyhocks, and many of us do still burn plant debris, although, of course, you must be careful to do that under the right weather conditions, and you must be sure to get permission from whatever community you live in before you burn. But burning will eliminate a lot of disease. But hollyhocks almost succumb to that hollyhock rust or fungus.
Yeah. And many municipalities now prohibit burning of yard waste.
Altogether, right.
Yeah.
Right. We are allowed to do it in my area under certain conditions at certain times of year, but you do need a permit.
Yeah. You know, another flower that seems to, its popularity waned for a while, and now it's back, petunias.
Yeah.
And the hybrids here, I'll stand up for some of the new varieties, the ones that are just marvelous producers of great flowers.
Oh, the wave petunias?
Yeah.
Are those the ones you're thinking
yeah.
of?
Yeah. They're terrific, but... Here in your book, there are petunias that are just dazzling.
Yes, they are pretty, aren't they?
The old ones, yeah.
Yes, there's an old-fashioned vining petunia that has a wonderful fragrance. Now, I've read that a century ago it was common in Iowa gardens. And they're very hardy, and they have these trailing, long stems. They've been described as smelling similar to Lily of the Valley. There's also the balcony petunia, which is an antique variety that's very large, and they have like these rich velvety blooms. They're really pretty in hanging baskets, and you can get them in lavender and mauve and white, pink, red, and purple. But I do agree with you. There are many wonderful modern varieties of all flowers, but I particularly do like those wave petunias.
Now, why do you suppose, we mentioned Love Lies Bleeding before, and it's a gigantic plant, and you really need a lot of space. The gentleman in Georgetown on his 18 acres, he could have a lovely area of Love Lies Bleeding. But you know, that aside, that kind of a consideration aside, why do you suppose that certain flowers come in and out of fashion?
Well, I think you just said the word. I think it's fashion. I think it's sort of the same reason that we don't listen to big band music or wear miniskirts anymore. I think a lot of it is style and fashion and taste. You know, at one time, cottage garden flowers evoked this vision of charming little cottages surrounded by all these wild flowery forms of flowers with tall, graceful stems and, you know, blossoms that look like they've been blown by the wind and these delicate pale colors. But today, we seem to prefer stockier plants with bold, bright blooms. And I think it's just a matter of style and taste. Gertrude Jekyll was a very famous garden designer, and I think it was in the early 1900s that she came out and said purple was a difficult color to work with in the landscape, and in the next few years, purple flowers were just, they were just terrible. Nobody wanted them anymore. It was just as if the tastemaker had ruled, and everybody said, okay, no more purple flowers.
Yeah.
So I think it's largely a matter of fashion.
Yeah, I think that's what happened to the petunia. The petunia was out in Vinca, or was it Vinca? Was in?
Well, Vincas, yes, they're very popular.
Yeah, so there you have
it. But I think petunias are making a comeback.
I think you're right, too. you know, I mentioned in my introduction that inside your fridge, we might very well find some brown paper envelopes mm-hmm. with seeds. When you, at the end, when you harvest and you want to save some of your own seeds, would you tell us a little bit about that process here to wrap up?
Sure. The best thing to do is just watch your plants as they're growing and keep an eye on the ones that are the healthiest, best ones in your garden, the most beautiful flowers, the most disease-resistant vegetables, the fruits with the best taste. Go ahead and watch those. Then as the season winds down and they begin to set seeds, those are the ones you'll want to collect the seeds from. As the seed capsules, if they're setting seed capsules, you can watch them until they're getting brown and brittle, and then you'll collect those seeds and dry them and then bag them. Make sure to label them. If they're vegetables, for example, tomatoes, you'll need to squeeze the seeds out, again, dry them, bag and label them. And generally speaking, you just want to keep your seeds in a cool, dark place until you're ready to use them again.
Okay, very good. There we will wrap it up. We're out of time. Been a pleasure talking with you, Lynn. Thanks so much.
Oh, thank you, Celeste. The pleasure was all mine, really.
Lynn Coulter has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's a gardener, and she is a writer, and she is the author now of Gardening with Heirloom Seeds, Tried and True Flowers, Fruits, and Vegetables for a New Generation. The publisher is the University of North Carolina Press.